give up his life, give it up voluntarily. We'd like to, of course, to associate it with some cause, some purpose, some accomplishment to be done by it. We'd rather make fun of those early Christian martyrs who were so anxious to be martyred, like the man in Androcles and the Lion, that he was just ridiculously coveting a martyr's death. I don't think, I say, we need worry much about that. Well, now, what did the Christians do then? They took this death with all its liabilities, some of which I've mentioned, and did what people commonly do, they turned it into an asset. So far from being a stumbling block or foolishness, it is the greatest asset of the Christian religion. It is, as they say, the central event, the central redemptive event. It is the one thing worthwhile that Jesus did. I need merely refer you to the ordinary gospel hymns, and you'll get all kinds of them. There are substitute terms for the death, but they mean the death, don't they? One of them is the cross. You know what that means in Christian talk. And the other one is the blood. But those are, for all practical purposes, synonyms for what we've been calling the death of Jesus. And they enter in largely into Christian thinking. Of course, the first thing you do is, when you have this awkward thing in the way, is to see if you can't apologize for it and explain it away and belittle it. And some of the things I've said were ways of doing that. It's certainly a consolation to know that although this is an awful handicap to Christian religion, that is no more than God intended or that Jesus expected. That's a help, isn't it? But then to go further than that and turn it into a positive asset is what the Christians did. Now, I had never talked to any psychologists about this, but I suspect that's fairly common psychology. I think you'd see it in children, and I think you'd see it in adults. A desire to say, well, I've seen a child break her favorite doll, and then say, I meant to do it. Too much to stand. To have the implication in anybody's mind that that was a disaster or a misstep, ill-omened or unfortunate. And that psychology, if I'm right in thinking it's a psychological characteristic of men, ultimately prevailed. Now, whether it prevailed from such motives, or whether it arose from other motives and rather came in here, I can't tell. It's most obvious in the Apostle Paul, though I should ask first, whether Jesus ever expressed in all his anticipation of this the idea that it was not too bad a thing. Of course, if he could say he would die and rise again, that takes a good deal of the sting out of it, doesn't it? And that in itself is of course the Christian view. And the death looked at as if it were the last chapter would be nothing but unmitigated gloom, wouldn't it? But since it's canceled by the resurrection, then I think it's not too bad. And therefore, you'd have to say, since the resurrection is so important, and not only my present colleague, but other early Christians thought that the resurrection, they were willing to say that we were saved by Jesus' resurrection. Therefore, the death was not what saved us, but we couldn't have been saved without it, because you couldn't have the resurrection without the death. But can you make the death mean more and more positively beyond that? And you can. There are two passages in the Synoptic Gospels. One where Jesus is represented as saying, "The Son of Man came not to wait on, not to be waited upon, but to wait upon people, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Now there you get in a nutshell, don't you? A positive view of the serviceableness, the social serviceableness of the death of Jesus. It was only the climax of a life of service, waiting on people. And even in that event, this Jesus as the servant of men comes in. And then at the Last Supper, in the Synoptic account, where he's talking about the breaking of the bread and the pouring of the wine, meaning respectively the breaking of his body and the pouring of his blood, again as symbols of his death, he brings in some of the accounts, the two words, "for many." Or, in an alternate account, "for you." For in the sense of on behalf of. In those two brief phrases, both of them occurring in Mark and the second one occurring in the parallel Gospels, you get the germ of a theory of the religious value to society of the death of Jesus. When you come to Paul, that is a prevailing view. Well, perhaps not quite so prevailing as you think it is, because Paul has a very complicated religious theory, and somehow or other the death of Jesus, though he's always bringing it in, is never quite clearly reduced to a formula. Paul believes that the Christian life is a life in which men are saved, and that somehow or other Jesus is responsible for that to those that are saved, and that somehow Jesus' death can be brought into that experience. But my trouble with Paul is that he has so many ways of saying what welfare Jesus does bring us, or rather so many illustrations of what it's like to have that welfare brought to us, that if you take each illustration, you get a somewhat different view of where the death comes in. For example, he believes the Christian life is freedom. And for him that means freedom from being under the weight of doing the law. And that that when you pass into the Christian religion from Judaism, you pass from a life of responsibility to the law to a life of freedom from the law. And then he says it's like this. As long as a woman's husband is living, she can't marry anybody else. But the moment he dies, she's free. A most grotesque use. But I'm not misrepresenting, I think. You'll find this is the sixth chapter of Romans.